Case number 17-1065 et al. T-Mobile USA, Inc. Petitioner versus the National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Theodore for the petitioner, Ms. Isbell for the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Mark Theodore. I represent T-Mobile USA in this matter. This is a textbook example of an NLRB decision that is not the product of reasoned decision-making. Given that the agency does not engage traditional rulemaking normally and instead hands down its rules of law by decision, it's of paramount importance that the agency explain the reasons for its decisions, taking into consideration the existing law and the facts before.
They did cite the Lovitz case.
They did, and they actually also specifically said, Your Honor, that this situation here, the suspension of bargaining, was not addressed by Lovitz.
Yes, but my point was, you say they didn't explain why they came up with these things. I mean, Lovitz, they went on at some length to explain the policies the board was adopting. Then it cited some other of its precedent as well. So where it has precedent, it doesn't have to write a book, does it?
No, it doesn't have to write a book, Your Honor, but I think in this case you'll see that when they went from explaining the principles of Lovitz to the rule, they didn't analyze or even cite any other law. So yes, they don't have to write a book, but they do have to explain what the reasoning is for the rule.
Didn't they go into great length as to why, as members of the board, they were coming up with this, what I'll call the either-or alternative?
Yeah, I don't.
And your client has offered a reason why the board, if I can put it this way, should reconsider that approach for the reasons it argues. And the board said, you know, we're sticking with the policy we had, that we're balancing different interests.
But that's the point of the appeal,
yeah.
Your Honor. There is no, this rule came out of nowhere. If you look at all of the decisions on this case, there is no either or. They explain, Lovitz explains a specific set of circumstances in which the employer can withdraw recognition.
Talking about the same case. This is where the employer was confronted with a statement by, what was it, 20 out of 21 employees?
Lovitz, or in our case, we had 13 of 20.
13 and 20. And your client decided he was going to continue to recognize the union for some purposes, but suspend all bargaining, right?
Suspend in-person bargaining, that's correct, Your Honor.
In-person bargaining?
Yes.
Suspend all bargaining as to the new collective bargaining agreement.
As to a successor collective bargaining agreement, that is correct, Your Honor. And the reason we did it is because of there was nothing up until this point in any case law that suggested that you must do one thing, or you must act on it. But there are cases
The case law was you must do one of two things.
Yeah.
You must either withdraw recognition, in which case you don't have to bargain, or you must recognize the union, or if you recognize the union, you must bargain. Those are the options up till this point, aren't they? And the board said, okay, there are these two cases, what are they, Lexis of Concord.
Right.
And, you know, one of the principles that we operate under is we owe deference to the board's interpretation also of its own case law. So on that case, the board says, that was a different situation.
Just a short.
You know, it was a temporary, there were other mitigating circumstances that didn't exist here. And it's hard for me to see how with this deferential standard under which we operate that we can get where you want us to go.
Well, I understand that.
Yeah.
And I think that, the full body of case law in this area, though, and we cite it in the brief, and the board, in fact, cites some of it in their brief, suggests that it has never been an either-or situation, and that that show industries, for example, is an example. Levitt's.
Well, but the board says that's a completely different case because, you know, the employer went out of business there, and that was a unique situation. But when you look at, you know, everything from Allentown, Mack to Levitt, it seems to be that this is a pretty clear rule the board has.
Yeah, I would suggest to you, if you look at Osceola Ironworks, which the board cites for different purposes
yeah.
in its brief, that suggests that there are pathways that
What happened in that case?
In that case, the employer had evidence that the union had lost majority status, but
it's
had
a case the board cites?
I'm sorry?
The board cites this case?
The board cites this case for a different reason,
uh-huh.
but in that case, uh-huh. It had an offer out to the union for a complete contract. The union accepted the offer, and the employer then withdrew recognition. The board initially ruled that, well, you can't do that because you reached an agreement. You can't withdraw a recognition once you have the agreement. They didn't explain their decision. It went back. It was remanded.
Isn't that true?
I'm sorry?
But there wasn't an agreement here, right?
But the
collective bargaining agreement here expired.
Exactly.
It was a different kind of case than that. There was no new agreement.
But if you're correct, Your Honor, except that in discussing the bright line rule in Osceola,
yeah.
Justice Souter laid out three options that are all lesser path that don't involve withdrawal of recognition, and that and with all go to withdrawing the proposals to reach an agreement. The first mm-hmm. option, he said, was you withdraw your proposal for an agreement, and then you file a petition, okay? And then mm-hmm. naively, perhaps, they dropped a footnote that said that that withdrawal of the proposal wouldn't serve the basis. We presume it wouldn't serve as a basis to block an election, okay? The second option is withdraw your proposal and just don't bargain anymore.
So why didn't you cite that case?
Because we felt the whole decisional law was not a bright line. I mean, we didn't cite all the cases.
Well, that's the Supreme Court.
It is the Supreme Court,
authority.
Your Honor. And the third option was withdraw your proposal and don't and investigate the situation. And we took a path that was right in between options two and three. And option one had already been taken by the employees.
Well, the board, though, at least it put everyone on notice. You can go different routes, but you do so at your own risk.
Exactly. And that's one of the reasons, exactly, Your Honor, why we took this lesser path, because when you fully explore all the facts in this case, you know that the employer believes and has asserted repeatedly that the charges that were blocking the petition were absolutely frivolous. And I think—
Is that what the board held?
No, but my point is this. I've been asserting—
I understand the employer's position, but it says this is management rights. I can amend the employee handbook whenever I want to and to say anything I want to. But the board didn't say the unfair labor practices filed were frivolous.
Well, Your Honor, I think I would submit to you that they did not say that, you're right, but I would submit to you that if you read the collective bargaining agreement, which is at Joint Appendix 247, you would understand that there is no way that those charges should have blocked anything. Okay?
Along this line, can I ask just a factual question, if I'm right about that? Am I correct that there is a decertification petition seeking election pending before the board?
Yes, there is, Your Honor.
How long has that been pending?
Since March of 2014.
And the board could have obviated all of this by acting on that petition, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. They had the discretion to move forward, and that is exactly my point. They could have looked at the agreement which said that any policy that was conflicting was trumped by the collective bargaining agreement, and that's just never been considered by anybody going up through this. The judge, as you know, found there was just no change because the at-will employee policy had appeared in the handbook several times before that, and that materially there were no other changes. However, the essence of the board's argument was twofold. One was that it altered the collective bargaining agreement, which manifestly was just not true, objectively not true. And the second item was that by issuing an at-will statement, the employer was demonstrating to its employees that
no point in joining a union.
The union was futile. Right. But that is, first of all, no one has ever cited a case to me that suggests that that's true. That doesn't.
That's why Congress set up the board, so these people who have some expertise in this area can make these evaluations.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor, except for one thing, and this is why the record is very, very important. The petition for decertification was filed after the charge.
Right.
By definition, it could not have, if that was true, the regional director could have said, well, as a legal matter, I'm taking the position that it interfered with employees who were signing these petitions and filing decertification petitions. No more decertification petition.
Well, what was interesting to me, among other things in this case, was that the pendency of these unfair labor practices, charges, regardless of their merit, were blocking the special election which the employer had, as I understand the record, said he was ready to participate in.
And we would abide by whatever results
so
occurred.
Because of that, what I was looking for was some case where the board had dealt with that problem. In other words, the employer says, I've got some indication that the union has lost its majority status. The board has said the preferred way is a special election. Let's have a special election. But then you can't do that because there are these unfair labor practices pending. And I understand why in some circumstances that would taint what was going on. But I didn't see that in this particular case.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. There's never been an allegation that anything, the decertification petition or the petition that was handed to my client, had any taint to it whatsoever. In fact, that's one of the reasons the board came down so strongly, I believe, to say, well, you could have just withdrawn. Okay, but when you're looking at it from the perspective of an employer, when you have charges like that are still pending, the risk becomes tremendous. Even if you believe they're frivolous, which we did, and even if we believe that we ultimately would prevail in our defense. And that's exactly one of the things that T-Mobile took into consideration in this case, is that the Levitt says if you withdraw recognition, you do so at your peril. The board, in its brief, even acknowledges that it's a, quote, grave, end quote, decision to do it. So we just took a lesser path, one of which we believe is not actively endorsed, but certainly evident in all of the decisional law in this, including the Supreme Court decisions on it, that there are just there's a recognition that at some point you have this information. We know some boundaries, right, from Osceola. If you don't act on the information and you reach an agreement, then you can no longer use it. On the other hand, our position was simply that we wanted to, whatever happened, it had to be final.
Counsel, suppose, this is just a hypothetical, or just not a hypothetical, but suppose I think, looking at the board's own decisions, that its interpretation of those decisions is making a policy decision that employers in this circumstance have two options and two options only, and that the other cases you cite are distinguishable as the board says they are because they're unusual circumstances that don't exist here. Is there, does that preclude you from succeeding, or do you have an argument that you can prevail here even if I view the cases that way?
Well, that's a good hypothetical, and I believe we fit in a rare category.
Tell me why that is.
Because nothing anybody can point to except the suspension, which is a purely legal issue,
is
that we acted in bad faith or otherwise violated the law. Most cases, as you probably have seen, involve many different kinds of allegations that, by the way, involve actual employees.
Mm-hmm.
There was no indication here that any employee even was aware of what was happening in this case.
Okay.
All right, why don't we hear from the board?
Thank you.
Give you some time on rebuttal. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. Kelly Isbell here on behalf of the National Labor Relations Board. Under Levitz and cases since the 1980s, employers have two choices. When they receive evidence that a union has lost its majority status, they can withdraw recognition or they can continue to bargain. Levitz is very clear. Even if you have evidence of a loss of majority support, you must continue bargaining if you go the route of the decertification election or the management election.
Despite the fact that that is board case law, that does not immunize it against an arbitrary capricious challenge, does it? The fact that you've done it before doesn't make it non-arbitrary and capricious, does it?
No, Your Honor, it does not. Except that in this case, it is the board's responsibility to set policy. The board followed Levitz, followed these older cases, Dresser Industries and RCA. And
this is not like a notice and comment rule. This is something that when you work the way the board does on case law, it is an inherently case-by-case aspect to it that doesn't seem to me to protect it against arbitrary and capricious challenge in a later case. Does it?
Well, I think if you're talking about how this rule will work out in later cases, I think
this one, for example.
I'm sorry?
Like this case, for example. It looked to me like your dissenter below and your ALJ both saw a great deal of merit in the third way, the lesser path chosen by the employer here. And is precedent alone a good enough reason to reject that without explaining why that isn't a good way to go?
I can't find any case except for these pretty rare examples that are factually distinguishable where the board or a court has allowed an employer to pick and choose what issues it will bargain about going forward to two rival unions or a decertification election. In that election process, the issue is the election and having a fair and
balanced. Why don't you have the election? The board has had a petition before for 3 years now. Why don't they have the election and put all this behind them?
The charges were blocked. The board's blocking charge policy is longstanding, going back as far as I can tell to 1937.
That doesn't make it right. I asked you for a why on that. Not whether you've done it before.
Because under the board's blocking charge.
Same argument. We had the same argument for IRS on the cases involving the discrimination by the IRS against certain groups. It said, well, we've always held up our rulings on tax-free status for all these years if there were litigation. We said that didn't make any sense. I don't know why it does here. If the board in fact is carrying out a policy of labor democracy, which is what our labor ancestors fought for, why don't they let the union members go ahead and vote?
There are two kinds of blocking charges. The first kind is the kind of charge that might interfere with an election. And even though the company has argued in its brief that these charges were frivolous. This is not an argument they made to the board. Once the regional director blocked those charges, and remember, it's the regional director's discretionary decision, he can block them. He found there to be enough evidence to go forward with a complaint on those charges.
And there's no reason that I can see why you couldn't simultaneously go forward with the vote.
Well, that is a direct challenge to the board's blocking charge rule, and once the regional director issues...
I understand that. But I do not see the reason behind it. It's a direct challenge. I'm directly challenging you to tell me why you don't let the workers vote on whether they want to be represented by this union or not.
Because the regional director has determined that those charges might interfere with the election. He decided to block the election. That decision by the regional director could have been challenged. There could have been a request for review filed. It was not filed, and I do not believe that issue is before the court, Your Honor.
Okay. But whether you win or lose this case is before the court, so you may wish to deal with the questions. But you've had your say, and I will let you go forward.
Well, I'm enjoying talking to you, so please continue to ask questions and don't think I'm...
I'm not through on that.
So under Levitz and Dresser Industries, there are two choices, and the board in its... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I just want to clarify a little bit. You say the regional director decided the charges might affect any election. Was there... such an explicit finding?
No, there are, under the board's case handling manual, there are two types of blocking charges. The kind of blocking charge that might have an effect on employee free choice in election, and then the kind of blocking charge you referred to it as taint, where it might actually taint the petition, and the petition might eventually be dismissed. Those kinds of charges are supervisors are collecting signatures on the decertification petition. And there was never any discussion in this case of there being any kind of taint, and the regional director certainly never dismissed the petition, so it's a type one.
And type one is?
Type one is the lesser kind. It might interfere with the election. So once...
Well, no, let me just be clear in my mind how you're... I think of taint as interfering with the election.
It's worse. It might lead to the petition actually being dismissed.
And then the other one is what?
Conduct that might interfere with the election but would not lead to the petition actually being dismissed. Once that conduct is remedied, the petition stays live.
Does the regional director have the authority under whatever guidelines or internal regulations to determine this is neither one nor two?
Yes, Your Honor. There are exceptions. So, he doesn't always have to block. There are exceptions. And, of course, it could have been... a request for review could have been filed with the board so that the board could review it.
Was there any way T-Mobile could have continued with its current policy, that is, not withdrawn recognition, but said, look, why don't we just put off negotiations until we see who wins the election? Could they have done that?
Well, I think under the board's decision, no. I mean, of course, if the union agreed and no charge was filed, then it wouldn't.
I mean, they could have said to the union, right, look, let's just wait. And if the union agreed, that would be okay.
Right, because the board, yes.
But if the union insisted on negotiating, it would have to negotiate, right?
Yes. I mean, you know, if the charge was filed, then it would come to us.
Right? No, I'm saying they could have said to the union, look, we're not going to withdraw our recognition, but why don't we just put things off until we see who wins the election, right? They could have done that, and the union could have agreed, and there wouldn't have been a problem, right?
Right. There wouldn't have been a problem because it never would have come to the board.
Correct.
Yes.
Now, if the union said no, we don't want to do that, then the employer wouldn't face a ULP, unfair labor practice charge, if it then said, okay, we'll negotiate. Right?
Correct.
Uh-huh. And so during this period of time, I take it if the union believed that the employer was not acting bargaining in good faith, it could file a ULP, even if the board's reason for sort of drawing out the negotiations was its concern that maybe the union didn't enjoy majority support, right?
That the employer could have filed a...
Yeah.
Yes.
No, the union. Right.
Yes.
Okay.
So here...
Yeah, can you just tell us once again?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I understand the board's policy. I've read it. So its reason for this policy is that as long as the employer recognizes the union, it needs to participate in all of its collective bargaining obligations, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The end?
No, I didn't have anything else.
Okay.
Sorry.
Not
a question mark.
Well, what I wanted to point out is that the issue here is whether or not the board's decision applying Levitz in this particular situation is reasonable. And what the board did here was set out a rule that's pretty easy to follow. What T-Mobile's rule, which in its view, of course, is also reasonable, would I think lead to is more uncertainty for employers and unions. Then the board has to decide in every single case, if an employer says we will bargain over non-economic issues but not economic issues, is that under the new T-Mobile rule an unfair labor practice or not? So that has to go to the board. How long is the hiatus between bargaining? Is it 6 months? Is it a year? All of those questions come to the board. Here, following more than 30 years worth of law, once you decide to go to an election, and the election under the board's rules must be free and fair, then you continue your bargaining obligations.
What about, what's your response to counsel's answer to my question when I asked him whether or not, assume I think the board has properly stated its rule here, namely that you just have two options, but there are some exceptions, which you acknowledge, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
His argument was, well, this is an exception. This is an exceptional case. What was your response to that answer?
My response is that the board didn't find it to be exceptional. I mean, the board found this to be a case where its traditional Levitz rule could apply. Uh-huh. You just keep bargaining. And if they had kept bargaining, those charges were dismissed. The election would have happened. Right now it's being blocked because of this refusal to bargain. I mean, the issue is going to the election, and by refusing to bargain, then you're signaling to the employees that the union is ineffective.
Yeah.
So your taint's not the right word because that's a legal term, but you're mm-hmm. affecting how the employees view the union before the election, and mm-hmm. that's what the board found to be improper. Show yeah. Industries, of course, is completely different. You can close your plant for any reason, and there's mm-hmm. nothing to bargain about.
So the option the employer had, you said, was to appeal the regional director's, what I'll call blocking decision, to the board. Is that right?
To continue to raise the issue of whether or not that blocking charge was proper, or the blocking letter was proper.
That's what I'm trying to understand. The employer says, I'm ready to participate in a special election. The regional director says there are these three ULPs. We can't have an election. Then what happens procedurally?
Procedurally, once the regional director decides.
He just did.
Right.
Then what? What is my option as the employer?
You could settle the charges with the
regional.
Okay, yeah. So we're going to assume there's no settlement. Then it plays out like it did here. There's a hearing before the administrative
law
judge.
So there is no appeal of the regional director's decision as such.
They can
the blocking aspect.
When the regional director sends it's a letter. We call it a blocking letter. When he sends out that blocking letter, that can be appealed to the board.
So and then I go to the board,
yeah.
and I say, I want an election. Then what happens?
The board may grant review and it may deny review.
I know. Take me forward, counsel, just so I understand this process.
In other words,
is the board going to decide the ULPs at that point?
If the...
I'm trying to run a business.
Right.
All right? I've got 13 employees who told me they don't follow the union, all right? From my point of view, it doesn't make much sense for me to bargain with this union about a new collective bargaining agreement. But the regional director has said, even though the board favors these special elections, we can't have one because of these ULPs. So the question is, how do I get either rid of these ULPs or get them decided on the merits so we can have this special election? As I understood it, 8.5 months passed.
Yes, Your Honor. So I'm going to analogize to the normal representation case context. If they filed a request for review, then the evidence before the regional director, if the board grants the request for review, the board says we will review it, the evidence before the regional director then goes to the board and a board attorney reviews it and the board would issue a decision.
So the board is going to make a de novo ruling on the ULPs before the regional director made a decision?
I think the board would not find whether or not those ULPs occurred. The board would look at whether or not those ULPs should block the election.
You mean whether they're in the class of ULPs that
right.
block the election?
I mean, this does not
but
happen very – I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm sorry.
This happens very rarely, and when I looked to find requests for review, I couldn't find one immediately where the board had granted review. So I'm not sure how the board would look at it, but it would not be doing an administrative law judge's job of figuring out whether the action happened that would impact the election. It would be looking at whether or not the blocking letter should have gone out. Whether
so
it was
where did I read that we look somewhat skeptically at employers who are looking out for employee rights with their union?
Osceola Ironworks, Your Honor.
So that's how the board comes down here. That the employer has to say, I'm not going to recognize the union anymore because I have what I consider to be firm evidence that the union no longer enjoys majority support. And then each employee who wants to use a company car has to negotiate independently with the supervisor, for example.
For example. Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just briefly, a couple things that came up in the argument. To my knowledge, and it certainly is not part of the record, there was no blocking letter that was issued. We were just told.
Wait, what did you just say?
That there is no nothing in the record that evidences that the regional director actually did anything in writing in blocking this. My recollection.
But is that relevant to what we're deciding today?
I believe so because
why?
Because again, with no blocking letter, there's nothing to appeal, and in any event, and so.
Do you make this argument in your brief?
No, I did not, because. As the dissent noted, we didn't challenge the blocking policy
because
we just don't believe it was followed. But I would point out a couple other things I just wanted to raise. The policy as written is fine. We never got a determination. But two things about that. One is once we suspended bargaining, a new charge was filed, and guess what happened? It proceeded to trial very, very quickly within 3 or 4 months after that. So. There is some action that occurred from that. And the other thing I wanted to just spend the last minute time.
What's the consequence of that?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Where does that take us?
It shows that when the board needed to act, it could, and resolve all of these interests, and it didn't until there was some more serious issue on the horizon, and that was the suspension of bargaining. They could have issued a complaint or not, or dismissed those charges months before. You know, the board is operating on a 100-day schedule for trials once they issue a complaint.
Well, they're trying to manage their docket, right?
Yeah, but that does have nothing to do with reaching a determination on the merits of a case.
No, but you say they could argue, they could decide all these other cases.
Right.
Okay, what is your other point?
The other point I would just raise very quickly is that and I read, I mentioned this in the brief, but I just wanted to reiterate it, was that the board on appeal takes the position that we engaged in piecemeal bargaining, and that just simply didn't occur. That's a term of art that applies only to specific bad faith situations where the employer unilaterally implements a term or condition of employment without bargaining, and that just didn't occur here. And that goes back to Judge Tatel's hypothetical that there were no tactics in this fall that were alleged to be bad faith bargaining. And the way the board characterizes it on appeal is somewhat nefarious. You know, we took this policy and we disabused the union of the notion, and that, not surprisingly, they accepted it. Now when you read the transcript, the union agent himself on the stand said that's bargaining. He didn't characterize it as good or bad or indifferent.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Your
Honor.
We will take the case under advisement.